Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
This Origins chapter is sponsored by Bleacher Report. Bleacher Report curates moments that matter for hyper-connected sports fans. Beyond scores and stats, they dig into the culture of what happens on and off the field, from the upcoming NFL season, drama in the NBA, or UEFA celebrations inspired by video games. Bleacher Report brings to your feed what you want to see with the fastest updates available. They don't have stuffy studio shows telling you how to think or feel. Their content digs into sports and the culture that surrounds it. That's why on Bleacher Report, you can watch an animated series lampooning NFL headlines or see stories of amateur athletes who are beyond inspirational, like the blind skateboarder who lands huge tricks. Bleacher Report provides a space for you and your friends to communicate about the sports you all love. It's a space to celebrate the art of the game and all that comes with it. The fun, the music, the fashion. After all, the stadium tunnel is Bleacher Report's new runway.
We won the national championship, right? We beat LSU. We had the rematch game and everything. Everyone's all excited, and you know, we're national champions again. We won in 2009. We won again in 2011. I'll never forget everyone, you know, they're thinking, okay, we got 2 or 3 weeks to relax before we have to even think about football again. 2 days after we win the national championship, we haven't even had the parade yet. Coach Saban calls a team meeting, and we're thinking, okay, well, you know, it's probably just some kind of logistics about the parade. He gets up there and he says, all right, guys, great season last season. I know it's 2 days after. I mean, some of us still have confetti in our hair. You know, it's 2 days after. He says, last year's in the past. Time to move on. If we really want to win the national championship next year, we got to rip off the rearview mirror. Forget about last year. We're on to next year, right? And we're thinking, man, 2 days. We only got 2 days to enjoy it. All that work for 2 days.
January 8th, 2018. Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta, Georgia. The college football playoff national championship between Alabama and Georgia has careened into overtime. The score, Alabama 20, Georgia 20. Alabama ball, 2nd and 26.
Stepping back, loads up, looks long, throws, end zone,
touchdown!
Touchdown, Alabama! Devontae Smith, touchdown, Alabama!
Alabama freshman and backup quarterback Tua Tagovailoa hits Devonta Smith with a shocking 41-yard touchdown strike, catapulting the Crimson Tide to the 2018 College Football National Championship.
Alabama is back as the champion of college football!
The title is Coach Nick Saban's 6th, tying him for the most by a coach in the modern era. Several hours later, following an on-field trophy presentation that felt like Times Square at the strike of midnight on New Year's Eve, and a heartfelt congratulatory speech Saban makes to his team, the coach sits down with a couple of his agents from CAA. The conversation turns to an essential question. Should Saban go back to the NFL? There are, not surprisingly, several potential suitors, including, reportedly, the New York Football Giants. The conversation doesn't last long. Saban decides to stay in Tuscaloosa. He loves it there. And perhaps more decisively, Terry, his wife of more than 45 years, loves it there too. And together, they both want more. More titles, more time at their favorite home of his career, and more time to guarantee that he will be regarded as the greatest college football coach ever. Welcome to Origins Chapter 3, Origins of a Champion, Nick Saban and Alabama's Crimson Tide. A journey inside the house of Saban, and a look at how Saban is preparing for his 10th year
as Alabama's head coach. We will talk with Saban himself, wife Terry, fabled strength coach Scotty Cochran, former Yankees manager and Saban friend Joe Girardi, former players, and others, all in an attempt to discover why Nick Saban's Alabama college football teams are so freaking successful. This exploration started in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, where I sat down one morning to get the story from Saban himself in his private office. It's just as you might imagine, well-organized, uber-masculine, and packed floor-to-ceiling with Saban memorabilia, enough for five or six commonplace living legends.
You know, my dad started Pop Warner football in our area in West Virginia, and I think when I was about 10 years old, because if you can get a picture, there were like seven coal mining towns, and a lot of the kids weren't able to participate because all these coal mining towns were up in hollows, you know, so we didn't have any transportation. The only way we'd get home was hitchhike, you know, after practice or whatever. So a lot of guys didn't participate. So my dad bought a bus, went and picked the kids up, took them home after practice. But the field that we had, Ida May Ball Diamond, in the one end zone, there was a mountain of a hill that was like layered and straight up. And our conditioning would always be to run this hill. And you had to, most of the time we practiced till dark. So you had to bring verification that you got to the top. You had to grab a leaf off a tree at the top of the hill. And it was a difficult conditioning process. Very difficult. And one that anybody that ever played for them always remembers. But, you know, it's those kind of things that are difficult and hard that I think you always remember.
Terry Saban is Nick Saban's wife of more than 45 years and is well known as a major influence in the coach's life. As major, really, as an influence can get.
Growing up in West Virginia, you have all these little communities that are separated by mountains. And during that time in our life, you didn't have cell phones, you didn't have any of the social media. So a mountain away in West Virginia was like a world away anywhere else. It was like a continent away. But even then, back in my little community, Nick's father's reputation was one of successful businessman because he owned a gas station and a Dairy Queen. That he was a man to be reckoned with in the coal mining community, that he was a leader in the community because he was a Pop Warner coach and owner of the gas station where everyone stopped and gathered every evening and discussed everyone's problems. And as I got to know Nick better and we started dating, and I was able to be around Big Nick and see him firsthand and watch his relationship with his son, you know, there was a lot of respect, but there was also some fear. He didn't talk a lot. He certainly didn't smile or laugh a lot. He was very focused, but he set a great example. You always knew you were loved. As a young boy, Nick went everywhere with his father, whether it was the trash dump or to line the baseball field, at all of his games. You always knew where you stood with Big Nick. Yes, he was a disciplinarian. Yes, he was tough, but he also had a big heart. And I'd like to think that Nick inherited those traits from his dad.
Scott Cochran was born on March 21st, 1979 in New Orleans and has a bachelor's in kinesiology and a master's in sports management, both from LSU. He joined Nick Saban at his alma mater in 2003 when Saban won his first national championship. In 2004, Cochran became an assistant strength and conditioning coach for the New Orleans Hornets and remained in that position until 2006. The next year, he reunited with Saban and the Crimson Tide. He spends a bunch of his time at the school's 37,000 square foot weight room. Cochran has been on staff for every Saban national championship win and is among the highest paid assistant coaches in the country. When Saban first came to Alabama, he told players that practice would be harder than games, a philosophy Cochran is credited with enforcing. He has also become well known for a tagline of sorts, the very succinct but somehow impactful, yeah, 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 which one hears constantly from the sidelines.
So I was working in the weight room at LSU. I worked for Tommy Moffitt as a volunteer, and then I worked my way up to a GA position and an assistant strength coach for him working with other sports. And helped out a little bit with football and got to know Coach through that. And then I went to the NBA, and when he got the job here, you already know, baby. Godfather of football calls, you come a running. You already know.
Players, current and former, have no problem remembering Cochran. Barrett Jones played for Saban at Alabama from 2008 to 2012 as an offensive lineman, and in 2011 was a unanimous first-team All-American and winner of the Outland Trophy, awarded to the nation's best lineman in college football.
The first day I ever got to Alabama, it was one of those Tuscaloosa days where it was probably 110 degrees, and the whole offseason they had been telling us the first day we get there, we're going to have this 110 test, and what it was 16 110-yard sprints, and you had 40 seconds in between each one, and you had to make each sprint in a certain time. My time was about 17 seconds. So I knew the first day I got there, I was going to have to run 16 110-yard sprints. I had no doubt. I'd trained for that. I was ready for that. I think most of the guys in our class were ready for that. They were ready to do that test just like it sounded. So we get there, and we actually board buses. And Coach Cochran, who's the strength coach, he gets us all on the bus, and he says, we're going to the stadium. We're going to run our first 110 test ever in the stadium. So here we go. We all bus off to Bryant-Denny Stadium. You know, I grew up watching some Alabama games, and so here's a dream come true. I'm walking into Bryant-Denny Stadium. I'd never seen it empty before. It looks a lot different empty. And, you know, normally being in the stadium would be a really cool thing, but on a day like this, a Tuscaloosa hot day, what the stadium did is it took 100 degrees to probably 120 degrees, right? There's no breeze. You almost feel like you're in a sauna, right, inside a stadium. There's no wind. It's just it's hot. It's one of those days when you walk outside, you feel like you're in an oven. So we get out there, and Coach Cochran, he says, all right, you guys know what's coming. We got 16 110-yard sprints. There's only one caveat. There's one rule, and that's that during this whole drill, you are not allowed to bend over. You can't bend over, right? You can't gasp for air, right? When you're tired, when you're running a lot of sprints, the one thing your body for some reason wants to do is bend over and try to get your breath. He says, there's no bending over. When you bend over, the opponent sees you're tired, and we're not going to have that at Alabama. We're not going to ever tell the opponent we're tired. There will never be any bending over in any drill we do. So we start running, and we probably run the first eight sprints, and everybody's doing pretty well, right? Everybody trained, and, you know, we get done with the first eight. You know, people are killing it. People are killing the drill. Everybody's excited. They're excited to be there. They're excited to be in the stadium. Probably about number nine, somebody, I can't remember who it was, but one of the players just gave a very subtle bend over. And Coach Cochran, he said, that one doesn't count. That rep doesn't count. And I'll never forget him saying that. There were a few other words mixed in, but we'll just say for now, that one doesn't count, right? That was the gist of what he said. And so I said, okay, that's fine. You know, 17, I can handle 17. It's just one extra. We get out there, we keep running. Somebody else, two reps later, bends over, right? That one doesn't count. Again, next rep, that one doesn't count. That one doesn't count. We ended up running 28 110s that day, right? 28 110s. I had been training, you know, for sports my whole life. I'd never thrown up. I'm not a throw-up guy. I was throwing up things from like three Thanksgivings ago.
What's the deal, Scott, with leaning over? I had a couple of former players who talked about they have these sessions where they're not allowed to lean over.
Ever. Ever. You are not allowed to ever bend over. And it's a mindset more than anything.
So it's not physiological.
Well, there is a physiological aspect to it because you got to think about it. If I'm hunched over, I'm closing up my breathing ways. So everybody always says, put your hands on your head, stand up tall, open your chest as much as you can to get as much air in, you know. And we try to coach them up, don't put your hands on your head either because it's showing weakness there too. But in Coach Saban's mind, if you're bent over, your opponent is licking their chops because they're like, oh, I got him now. I got him exhausted. He's hurting. I can get him now. And our goal is to never show that weakness. The best part about it is when the guys learn that, they find out when they're 30, 40 years old and they've gone through this program that they do their best not even to yawn when they're at work. You know, just little things like that that becomes their part of their process. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's almost like the physical equivalent of poker, right? You're just not going to give anything away.
Exactly right. You're not going to let them know you're breaking me. And, you know, we coach the guys hard because we want them to be ready for that, you know? I'm sure they'd much rather get yelled at, screamed at by me or Coach Saban or their position coach than lose a game.
But I heard you never raise your voice.
Come on. Come on, baby. You know better than that.
I love that story because I think it just encapsulates so perfectly the program. Like, bending over doesn't actually matter as far as, like, doing the drill. You know, they say you can get air better when you stand up straight. I don't even know if that's actually true. Most coaches would say, as long as you're making your times, I don't really care what you're doing. But it's not about that, right? It's not about the function. It's not about the results. It's about the process. It's about the standard. It's about that's the way we do things at the University of Alabama. It doesn't matter what you think about it, if you like it or you don't like it. We're doing it this way.
After limited playing time in his first two seasons at Alabama, quarterback Greg McElroy led the Crimson Tide to an undefeated 14-0 season in 2009, which included the SEC Championship and the BCS National Championship. He was also named MVP. In 2010, McElroy was named a first-team Academic All-American. He finished his college career with a 24-3 record. The New York Jets drafted McElroy in 2011, and he retired from the Cincinnati Bengals in 2013. McElroy is currently working as a commentator at ESPN.
It was in your hands as a leader of the team on the field that you brought him the first national championship in 2009, correct?
I was a part of that. Some would say that I was a hindrance in some ways that year, but I was a part of that team, and we were part of his only undefeated championship team, which I still kind of have to pinch myself to think about, to think how many times he's won it, and for us to be a part of a bit of a unique team, and the fact that we never had to experience that difficult nature of dealing with a loss was kind of special.
So how does Saban as a coach keep the level of play so high during an entire season? I mean, obviously that's a coach's job, but when you're talking about that kind of demand for excellence day in and day out, what do you think in terms of his formula, his recipe, the way he treated all of you that got those kind of results?
Well, at the time, Jim, I just didn't know any better. All of us were on the team. We only had, for the most part, one college experience outside of a transfer or two here and there that would come in to the program. When you only have one college experience, there's not really anything else to draw from. And what I didn't realize until I got into a role at ESPN and started going around and seeing other practices was just how hard we practiced in school and the accountability that was expected every single repetition throughout the course of the season. So it's almost like Bill Belichick, where fear is used to a certain extent to make sure that they get the most out of the actual players themselves. Because you never walk into it feeling nervous about losing your job or anything like that. But you know deep down, whether it's said or not said, that if you don't perform well in a rep, in a practice, in a period, your job is very much in jeopardy because of the way he's recruited. So I think that he has a standard that he sets for the program, but that's entirely due to the amount of depth that he has within the roster and knowing that every single player, they might be a first rounder down the road, but they are absolutely replaceable if they're not willing to toe the line.
Bleacher Report's path from a startup with no financing to a hot property snapped up less than a decade later by Turner for more than $200 million is itself worthy of an origin story. In our episode intermissions this time, we're going to hear directly from the company's leaders insights and stories behind their dramatic success. It all started with Dave Finocchio, one of Bleacher Report's co-founders.
I was one of those people who never had any idea what I wanted to do. And I, at a certain point, just kind of had these observations about sports writers were out of touch with my generation. At the time, I kind of snapped a little bit. It involved a Notre Dame basketball game, and specifically a player on the team named Taryn Francis. And Taryn was a McDonald's All-American in high school. He was maybe supposed to spend 1 or 2 years max at Notre Dame, but he'd had a bunch of back issues, and the guy never had great hands. And it was very clear at that point that he was never going to have an NBA career and was like, best case, a Europe guy, but probably not even that. And so I go to this basketball game on campus, and the next morning I wake up, and there's an actual honest-to-God column about Notre Dame basketball. And some poor writer, who in fairness to the writer, probably watched the basketball team play one time, wrote this glowing review of Taryn Francis, who had had a good game the night before, but specifically said, you know, look out for this guy to be a lottery pick in this year's draft. And that, for me, was just kind of like I snapped a little bit and said, you know what, this model is just broken. I mean, you know, there are thousands of people in the fan base who have better information than this guy has. So, like, it just made me think that this space was a little bit of a mess and that sports fans of a lot of different teams deserved better than they were getting. That was one of the light bulb moments for me, for sure.
True story. When I first tried One Blade Razor, I gave up after 45 seconds. But the packaging was so cool. So that Saturday morning, I tried it again. This time, I actually read the instructions and decided to be, God forbid, a tad patient. The One Blade experience turned out to be time well spent. The design is awesome. They spent over $1 million and had over 1,000 prototypes to build the world's best razor. One Blade didn't set out to create a good razor or even a great razor. Their goal was to create the perfect tool to deliver the perfect shave. And after using it, there's no doubt that they succeeded. Because the one thing that One Blade teaches you is it's not just about the razor, it's about the total shaving experience. This situation is simple. You get a barbershop shave at home. My face has never felt better. And by the way, you get a lifetime guarantee with this thing. And if you don't like it, there's a no-hassle 60-day trial. No harm, no foul. But I doubt you'll want to let go of it. It's just that good. If you are ready to elevate your shaving experience, try One Blade today. Listeners should go to onebladeshave.com and enter the discount code ORIGINS15 at checkout for 15% off their entire purchase. That's onebladeshave.com and enter the discount code ORIGINS15 at checkout for 15% off your entire purchase. One Blade. Come for the shave, stay for the deep breath.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Lane Kiffin has taken one of the most dramatic, circuitous treks of any football coach in modern memory. And following both triumphs and much publicized controversies at USC and Tennessee, among others, Saban offered Kiffin a chance to repair his reputation, giving him the job of offensive coordinator from 2014 to 2016. Did you have any trepidations about working for him?
I mean, I had talked to people and you'd heard the stories and things, but, you know, I felt that those things that people had talked about, you know, whatever those difficulties or that environment was, worth it comparable to what you would learn, you know, from going there. You know, I had been in a completely opposite environment as an assistant coach. You know, I'd been a head coach, obviously, at Oakland, Tennessee, USC. Well, prior to that, when I was assistant coach, was 6 years with Pete Carroll. So that's really all I knew. So to go from that environment to a Nick Saban environment, and I'm not saying which is right or which is wrong at all. I'm just saying they are, from A to Z, completely polar opposite.
Could you give me an example of, like, World A versus World B?
Again, I'm not saying which one's better. They're just totally different leadership styles, you know, on the way that communication with people, treatment of people, players, it's just different. And both can work, as they have, you know, two of the best coaches in the history of college football.
Is there a memory you have of Pete Carroll that, just in terms of working with him, that might be emblematic of his style and that kind of world that he creates as a head coach?
Yeah, the best way I would describe it is, create an environment of want to versus have to. Not just for your players, where they want to come around, they want to come to practice, they want to come to workouts, but that your coaches do too, versus that they have to. You know, where the coach is driving into work and morning going, God, I got to go to work today. I don't really want to because I don't really like it there. It's not a fun environment. It's not positive. It's negative. So Coach Carroll was all about positivity, treatment of people, treatment of players, fun environment. Everyone feel like they were involved. That's what he did, and it wasn't by accident.
Did you ever use the word fun environment to characterize the Alabama environment?
No.
A former player said to me they loved playing in games because not only was the crowd there, but because it was easier than practices. I mean, are you at a point now getting ready for the season where these guys are starting to suffer?
Oh,
yes, sir. This is week 5 or week 6 right now that we're into the off-season program. In that fourth quarter program, we are in week 5 or week 6 right now.
For someone who isn't familiar with the phrase, could you describe what the fourth quarter program is?
So fourth quarter program is 60 minutes of conditioning. Front to back, top to bottom, it's 4 days a week. You're going to run 110-yard sprints, whether it be a straightaway or a curve. You're going to do speed improvement drills. Speed improvement drills are your high knees, your butt kicks, your ankle flips, your bounding. The agilities are going to be on another day completely, where you do bag drills, cone drills, short distance sprints, and then Thursday, Friday, you basically do just the opposite of what you just did. So that means that we are going to lift 3 times a week. We're going to run 4 times a week. And then they do 7-on-7 and stuff like that on their own.
And are you keyed into their diets as well?
Yes, 100%. We're all on the same page. Between the athletic trainer, the nutritionist, all three of us are on the same page because we're all trying to, obviously, gain muscle and lose fat.
Do you pay attention to sleep as well?
Yes, we do the sleep monitoring. And honestly, the best thing for sleep is to educate them. And so we have a lot of speakers come in during the summer, but we have a lot of meetings, and it's called Mental Conditioning for Success. And so we spend time in the classroom 2-3 times a week to discuss, okay, here's our topic, but basically, we answer the question, why? Why do we run the way we do? Why do we monitor the sleep the way we do? Why do we focus on the diet? Why do we do this in the weight room? Why do we have 7-on-7? All the whys, we try to answer those so that they take ownership. And when the players take ownership, special things happen.
I should come down there for a couple of weeks.
Come on, nah, don't do that. No, it's not safe.
The reason that we train so hard, I think, obviously you want to be in good shape for football, but I think most of it is to kind of create that mental toughness, to create that edge. You know, you think you're tough, but you really can't know that until you've been pushed to that point. I think that was the main job of the strength coaches. They were the biggest parts probably of sort of truly indoctrinating us to the standard process lifestyle because they were with us every single day. That's one of their main goals, is to like push us past our self-imposed limitations. You know, the mind quits long before the body ever does. That was one of the things we always said. And I really believe that.
You may ask why former Yankees manager Joe Girardi is now joining us. And the answer is fairly simple. Girardi and Saban formed a friendship many years ago. And in 2015, Girardi cited Saban as one of his significant influences as a manager, praising Saban for his organization, his relationships with players, and the idea of winning each play. The two men share a particular fondness for 2009, the year Saban won his first national championship at Alabama, and the year Girardi managed the Yankees to a World Series title. Both men have invited one another to come and talk to their teams. I asked Girardi if the Yankees, professionals and for the most part older than Alabama players, were eager to hear from Saban.
I think anytime you have a chance to listen to someone who has accomplished as much as he has as a coach, you're going to listen, because obviously he has a lot of right formulas and there's going to be a lot of wisdom. You know, maybe for some of the Mississippi State guys, they weren't so excited to see him. But, you know, the one thing about athletes is they usually love other sports. And kids that went to college usually get involved with college football and watching games, and they were excited to see him.
Did you remember what he said about being there and talking to the Yankees?
Well, he grew up a Yankees fan. He grew up in West Virginia, and I think it was he used to go to his friend's dad's store, and they used to listen to the games on the radio. And it was, you know, I didn't know that about him before I met him, that he was a huge Yankee fan. And you think, how does a young man from West Virginia become such a Yankee fan? And he was, and I thought that was interesting. But I could listen to him all day.
You were invited down to Alabama to speak to the team. What was that like for you, and what was your approach?
Yeah, I started thinking, why would Nick Saban, as accomplished as he is, would want me? But I talked about being the hunted. Alabama's the hunted. They have to bring their best every game because the team that's playing them, it's their national title game, you know?
And you feel like some connective tissue with the Yankees, right?
Yes, yeah. I mean, you have to bring your best, especially when you're at a time where you're winning a lot and people are gunning for you, and you never get a mental break, in a sense. Like, some teams will let down against other competition, but never against Alabama, never against the Yankees. They're going to bring their best. They're going to want to make their season by beating you or winning the season series. So I talked about being accountable to each other and watching out for each other. I mean, you guys are all 17, 18, 19, 20-year-old kids. You're not always going to make the best decisions, so your job is to protect each other from making bad decisions. Because I feel like there's a lot of temptations and there's a lot of time you have on your hand. You got to protect each other. In college football, I mean, they're together from the end of July all the way, you know, hopefully, God willing, to the middle of January. It's a long time. And you got to learn how to be accountable to each other and to work together.
We're speaking now in the off season. Is your methodology different in terms of gearing up for a new season after you've won a national championship? Or do you still have the same kind of operational guidelines that you use for preparing yourself and preparing the team for a new season?
Well, I think the operational guidelines, you're always trying to improve, whether you win the national championship or you lose on the last play of the game or you didn't even make it to the playoffs, because you're always looking for a better way.
What are you thinking about the new season? I mean, obviously there's the particulars of the schedule, but are you now at the point where you're starting to really think about tactics and other things like
that? Well, I think these things all work hand in hand. You know, I think mindset of the team is something that's a process and it's ongoing. It's a work in progress all the time. Okay, here's what the teams that we play are going to do. How do we need to prepare our players to be able to respond and have a readiness to be prepared to play against this stuff, whether it's what somebody does on defense, offense, special teams, or whatever. So there's a technical aspect, and there's a mindset that you're always trying to create throughout your team, which is, you know, basically what reflects the culture in the long run of the kind of team you want to have. And that's something that you preach, sell, try to get people to buy into, and understand that buying into these things and everybody buying into the principles and values and the standards is what's going to help us have a chance to be a good team.
Is this an exciting time of the year for you, or is this a time when you're like a little on edge because you want all those things to play out the right way?
I hate to think that I'm on edge. I'm always sort of have a certain level of intensity, mental intensity in terms of the issues that we face, a sense of urgency, immediacy, and want to think things through intelligently so that you don't make mistakes, whether it's in personal development of the team characteristics that you're trying to develop or the technical aspects of what you're trying to develop.
After you win a national championship, first of all, you've probably heard Coach Saban say he gets frustrated about the national championship because it's so late in the year that he feels like he's missing out on recruiting. You know, that just kind of that describes him. He said, I hated the taste in my mouth in 2009. I felt like we had a sloppy year in 2010 because we spent too much time celebrating. And so this year, I'm not waiting. I'm taking 2 days and we're getting back at it. So sure enough, even before the parade had started, he had coaches up there already game planning for the next season, right? Already getting everybody's mind to move on. And hey, you know, it sounds ruthless, but it worked, right? We won the national championship again in 2012. We repeated back to back because 2 days after that national championship, we were already focused and on to the next year. That's the kind of focus. I've never been around a coach who would actually do that, who would tell players to move on after 2 days. And I love it. I love it. I mean, that's what it takes to be great. He understands it. He knows it. And it just kind of encapsulates who he is.
Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy. And you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/origins. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never have to miss a great match. With results like that, it's no wonder that ZipRecruiter is the highest-rated hiring site in America. And right now, Origins listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/origins. That's ZipRecruiter.com/origins.
ZipRecruiter.com/Origins. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Tom Rinaldi calls himself a generalist, but serves, among other duties, as a sideline reporter for ESPN at the College Football Championship, the Rose Bowl, and other major college games throughout the season. Rinaldi has spent a great deal of time interviewing Saban and has been a guest on the coach's radio show. The two, evidently, have forged a strong rapport. When I told Saban that Rinaldi had sent along his best, Saban smiled at me and said, "Tell Rinaldi I said he's full of crap." Rinaldi graduated from Penn, received his master's from Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, and has shelves crammed with 12 sports Emmys in addition to 6 Edward R. Murrow Awards.
Tom, you've been around a lot of successful players and coaches. How much of an outlier is Nick Saban?
I think he's a pretty significant outlier. He is unique. I have been fortunate to be around a lot of different coaches and athletes because I'm a generalist, Jim, and cover a lot of different sports. But there's a number of things which I think signify how different he is. A lot of times when a coach or an athlete or anyone has great success, that leads to a type of deafness. Why would you change anything? Why would you listen to another or a newer voice? What you're doing is working. It becomes instead a fight to continue to do exactly what you've done. He absolutely contradicts that thought and theory. He's always seeking a newer voice. He's always seeking a different way, a new look, a different thought. That's manifested all the time, Jim, in the speakers that he brings in to talk to the team. People who are both rooted deeply in football and distant from the sport in any way. It deals with what types of books he reads, the types of people he tries to talk to gain ideas from. And I find a great humility in that, that he is still a student. He still wants to learn. Because there may be an advantage, something to gain, another inch, another idea, and he relentlessly pursues that. He also flips on its head the notion that people operate at their best when they're not tense. You enter the building and it feels pressurized. People are not comfortable as a default position. They know that a great deal is demanded of them. They know they're going to be placed in positions that are going to make them uncomfortable, and they're expected to operate through that and succeed in that. There aren't that many situations or enterprises where that's a successful dynamic, where you just want to put people under great stress, and yet the results speak for themselves.
I certainly felt that when I walked in there. It was very intense.
Why did you feel?
I think because you're in a world where there's little margin for error. And the only good news is that you're aware of it and you need to adapt to it. You just have to be on top of your game. Every facet of the building, it's a high wire act, and you got to like being up there. And that idea also that there's not a net.
And that idea that life without a net is not sustainable, he defeats that through sheer force of personality, sheer will. This is a demanding environment, and if you don't want to meet those demands or you can't, no ill will, but get out.
For anyone who is silly enough to forget the nature of Saban's absolute power at Alabama, I give you Exhibit A. When the stakes were the highest, before Bama's national championship game against Clemson in January of 2017, Lane Kiffin was notified that his services as offensive coordinator were no longer wanted. Not next season, the next week. He wouldn't have a headset. He wouldn't be on the sidelines. He wouldn't be at the game.
You've had 360 degrees of experiences as an assistant coach and a head coach in your career. Great triumphs and some tough times. That conversation about hearing that you were going to be out of the championship game, is that the most difficult or is it the top three, top five?
That depends on how you think the conversation went. You know, there's a lot of different stories out there about what really happened, so... And like I said, I don't want to get into that.
No, I understand. I'm just talking about in terms of just you processing things and you having to go through things as a leader and as an individual. Was it one of the most difficult things that you had to go through?
The difficult thing for me was watching the game. And if they were going to lose, which obviously I wanted them to win, it would have been a lot easier if they would have just lost by 28 points or something. The fact that the game was so close, you know, the third down struggles on offense, you know, Jalen's play who obviously is the quarterback coach coordinator, you're directly responsible for, and the game to go down to one play, you know, and I would hope anyone would say this, so I don't, this is not arrogant. We would have won if I was there. Well, I would hope that if it's a one play game, that the coordinator, which is the only play caller that the true freshman quarterback knew, you know, his entire career, you know, isn't there all of a sudden for you for the final game. So that was a difficult thing for me, knowing how hard those players work there the entire year, offense, defense, special teams, how hard it is there, and all the work they put in, that to come down to being that close to winning a championship was tough to watch.
Did you reach out to them afterwards?
Well, within the hour, yeah.
Once again, Greg McElroy.
It was during the national championship game. We were playing against the Texas Longhorns, and the Texas Longhorns were incredible and really good football team. Unfortunately, the best player on their team was Colt McCoy, and he got injured on the first drive of the game, and he was unable to return, and I've known Colt forever, so it kind of broke my heart, but I'm not going to lie, seeing Garrett Gilbert out there on the field, it made me a little bit more comfortable, to be frank. Knowing that you're going to have a true freshman going up against our defense, it's going to be tough for them to mount enough points to eventually beat us. And we were up 24-3 at halftime, so it was one-sided. Without question. Third quarter, they make some adjustments. They hit a couple big plays. And next thing you know, blink of an eye, it's 24-21. And all of us are kind of sitting there like, what happened? You know, when we were just had a very comfortable lead, a 3-touchdown lead, and all of a sudden it's a field goal game. We better put a drive together. Eventually, we get the ball back, put a little drive together, pin them deep. Our linebacker, Eric Anders, comes around the corner, sacks Garrett Gilbert, fumble, we score on the next play, and that was essentially the icing on the cake, and it was over. We're celebrating, confetti everywhere, first national championship in 17 years. We're just so incredibly proud, and frankly, for lack of a better word, relieved. We get back to the locker room. Coach Saban says something along the lines of this: seniors, I'm so proud of you. Thank you guys for buying in. When we got here, you didn't have to follow our lead, but you did, and you bought in, and now you've been rewarded. Alabama's back as a result of your leadership. You guys coming back, that's not the way we play in the second half. You know, hey, we got to make sure that we play 60 minutes in the ball game. I'm proud of you, but we'll get that sorted out. But enjoy the night. This is a great moment for Alabama. Just, hey, think a little bit more about how we can finish this game a little better next time we get here. So it's just, it's him, though. He's just constantly thinking about what's next. What's next? How can I teach as a result of this experience, more so than, man, you know, what a great moment. What a great moment. He's always said, so what, what's next? And I'm not sure there's a story that better explains that line of thinking than the one that involved him yelling at us a little bit after the game in the national championship.
When I look at Scott Cochran and the job that he's done, you see that his players are physically superior, his players are superior to other clubs. And it's the work that they put in, and it's a foundation that they set for success, because if you don't have your health and your strength on a football field, you're in trouble. But to me, what it says about Coach Saban, which people probably don't think, is the people that he hires, he trusts to do their job and allows them to do their job. And you see them flourish, because you can't micromanage everything. You got to trust your coaches. And I think that's what I love seeing about him, that he trusts Scotty.
Who draws the line, and how do the two of you come up with the formula for how you're going to train these players?
Well, it's great that you asked that, because I'm going to tell you, we are doing the same exact program that I don't know if he did as a player or but he learned as an assistant coach. We do that same exact program when it comes to the off-season program. So he knows every position inside and out. And when it comes down to, you know, how hard should we push them right now, you know, I don't want to say it's been a trial and error, but there have been some instances where, you know, maybe we needed to push them a little bit harder. Maybe we needed to pull back during this period so that we were better 3 weeks down the line. This past weekend, I had all the freshmen to the house to come eat, you know, and I cooked for them. You know, I didn't bring people in to cook. I cooked, and I said, hey, let's break bread. Let's talk. Let you see what my house looks like with my family and my kids. You know, when Coach Saban does the same thing, he's going to bring in the leadership group to his house and have them over, do a barbecue with them, and have them on the boat. And then he's going to have the freshmen over right before we start camp.
And I think getting to know them is really, to me, that is a huge part of the battle. I think that's 70% of knowing who they are and what they're about. And it opens up doors, you know. And obviously, Coach Saban gives us the resources to get it done, baby.
At the conclusion of every game, after Nick gets through with all the different duties that he's got to handle with the team, the media, handling anything that could be considered official, he will ultimately get in his car with Terry, and they will play the same song, the first song that they play in the car on the drive home. And then the song is Gimme Shelter. And they do that as ritual and routine. Now, there's a lot of different songs you could play. But to me, there's so much in that, that when it's just the two of them and they get together and they're in that car, Gimme Shelter is the song that they dial up. And I think that's what she is for him. She's his shelter. She absolutely rules the roost. And she is as funny and big-hearted and bright, just an incandescent personality.
We do love music. You know, back in seventh grade, when we were kind of liking each other, we used to go to the Valley Fire Department dances. So we grew up that, you know, we liked to go to concerts. You know, he likes the Eagles and the Rolling Stones and Michael Jackson. And I have to say, though, I'm ready for something a little different because he does put the same songs on over and over. But I guess he's only in the car for about 6.5 minutes every day, so they're new to him.
In late July of 2018, Alabama extended Nick Saban's contract by 1 year, which will have him leading the Crimson Tide through the 2025 season, and also includes significant raises in his current deal. As a result, Saban is now the first college football coach who has a guaranteed annual salary of more than $10 million. It also means, as Darren Revell has pointed out, that over those 19 seasons, Alabama will wind up paying Saban $126 million, which averages out as $18,169 a day. For those who remember him, Alabama's famed coach Bear Bryant made roughly $18,000 a year.
Way back when our first NFL job, I want to say we were with the Cleveland Browns and we won our first playoff game, which gave us our first huge bonus, which in our mind was huge bonus. It was probably $8,000. And it was the first time we got a real chunk of money for winning some big championship. And, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, pay off the Visa bill, get a baby grand piano, go to the beach. Okay, I'm thinking of all, dreaming about all these wonderful things we could do with that check. And I'll never forget, Nick came home and he said, I think it's time we did something for your parents. My dad was a coal miner, and of course, everything he had was the Cleveland Browns sweatshirts and coats and hats and jackets. And so we arranged to pay off his mortgage on his house, which, you know, not a lot, but at the time it seemed like a lot to him. And it was one less thing they would have to worry about on a monthly basis. So we did. We paid off the mortgage and we got the title to the house, and I stuck it in a pocket in the Cleveland Brown jacket. And I'll never forget him opening that jacket and putting it on and tipping his hat and laughing and saying, man, it fits. I love it. And I said, check your pocket, Dad. And he reached in and saw the title. Oh, I could cry. Title to the house. And he got tears in his eyes and he said, now I can die in peace. I guess because Mom wouldn't have to worry about the house. But it's who Nick is, and people don't see that side of it.
Coming up in episode 2, you'll hear why the mental game is often more important to Alabama's success than the physical game. For Origins, I'm Jim Miller. This has been a Cadence 13 production.
I mean, it was everything. It was the center of the cultural universe. It really was, and I am not overstating that.
MTV started as an all-music video cable TV channel, and it became something much bigger. It was the global youth culture brand for decades. At the beginning, it was like a cultural rocket ship. Now, things are a little different. My name's Dave Holmes, and because I used to work there, pretty often people ask me, what happened? And what I learned isn't just the story of the greatest TV channel of all time. It's the story of pop culture before it got atomized by algorithm-driven entertainment. Join me and a whole bunch of fascinating people whose lives intersected with MTV as we try to answer the question, if video killed the radio star, who killed the video star? Follow and listen to Who Killed the Video Star? The Story of MTV, an Odyssey original. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.